Chapter 8. Four of them were around me before I saw one of them. I was barely awake. I had sat up on the open hillside by the dead fire alone. They were around me, without movement, out of the grass, out of the dim gray air of early dawn. I looked from one to the next and sat still. They were armed, not like soldiers, but with short bows and long knives. Two carried 5-foot staffs. They looked grim. One of them finally spoke in a soft, hoarse voice, almost a whisper. "Fire out?" I nodded. He went and kicked at the few half-burnt sticks left, trampled them carefully, felt them with his hands. I got up to help him bury the cold cinders. "Come on, then," he said. I bundled up my blanket and the last scraps of dried meat to carry. I wore the cape of rabbit and squirrel skins for warmth.
"Stinks," said one of them. "Reeks," said another. "Bad as old Kuga."
"He brought me here," I said.
"Kuga? You was with him?"
"All summer." One stared, one spat, one shrugged. The fourth, the one who had spoken first, motioned with his head and led us down the long hill towards the forest. I knelt to drink from the stream at the foot of the hill. The hoarse-voiced leader nudged me with his staff while I was still drinking thirstily.
"That's enough. You'll be pissing all day," he said.
I scrambled up and followed them across the stream and under the dark eaves of the trees. He led us all the way. We moved hastily through the woods, often at a trot, until mid-morning, when we stopped in a small clearing. It smelled of stale blood. A pack of vultures flapped up heavily on great black wings from some remnants of guts and skulls. The carcasses of 3 deer had been butchered and hung, glittering with flies, high from a tree limb. The men brought them down and divided and roped them so each of us could carry a load of meat, and we set off again, but now at an easier pace. I was tormented with thirst and by the flies that kept swarming around us and our burdens. The load I carried was not well balanced, and my feet, sore from the long walk yesterday, blistered in my old shoes. The trail we followed was very slight and winding, seldom visible more than a few paces ahead among the big, dark trees, and often made difficult by tree roots. When we came at last to a stream crossing, I went right down again on hands and knees to drink. The leader turned back to stir me up, saying, "Come on, you can drink when we get there." But one of the other men was down with his face in the water too, and looked up to say, "Ah, let him drink, brigand." The leader said nothing then, but waited for us. The water bathed my feet with wonderful coolness as we waded across the stream, but then as we went on, the blisters grew worse, my wet shoes rubbing them, and I was hobbling with pain by the time we came to the forest camp. We cast down our burdens of venison in an open shed, and I could stand up straight at last and look around. If I'd come there from where I used to live, it wouldn't have looked like anything at all. A few low huts, a few men, in a meadow where alders grew by a small stream, dark forest all around. But I came there from the lonesome wilderness. The sight of the buildings was strange and impressive to me, and the presence of other people even stranger and more frightening. Nobody paid any attention to me. I got up my courage and went to the stream under the alders, drank my fill at last, then took off my shoes and put my raw, burning, bloody feet in the water. It was warm in the meadow, the autumn sun still pouring into it. Presently, I took off my clothes and got into the water entirely. I washed myself, then I washed my clothes as well as I could. They had been white. White clothing is worn by a girl in her betrothal ceremony, and by the dead, and by those who go to bury the dead.
There was no telling what color my clothes had been. They were brown and gray. Rag color. I didn't think about their whiteness. I laid them on the grass to dry and got back in the stream and put my head under water to wash my hair. When I came up, I couldn't see, for my hair hung down over my eyes. It had grown so long. It was filthy and matted, and I washed it again and again. When I came up from the last dip and scrubbing, a man was sitting beside my clothes on the stream bank, watching me. "It's an improvement," he said. He was the one who'd told the leader to let me drink. He was short and brown, with high, ruddy cheekbones and narrow, dark eyes. His hair was cut short to his head. He had an accent, a way of talking that came from somewhere else. I came up out of the water, dried myself as well as I could with the old brown blanket, and pulled on my wet tunic, seeking modesty, though there seemed to be only men around, and also seeking warmth. The sun had left the clearing, though the sky was still bright. I shivered. But I didn't want to put the filthy fur cape on my hard-won cleanness. "Hey," he said, "hang on." He went off and came back with a tunic and some kind of garment I didn't recognize. "They're dry, anyhow," he said, handing them to me. I shucked off my limp, wet tunic and put on the one he gave me. It was brown linen, much worn, soft, long-sleeved. It felt warm and pleasant on my skin. I held up the other piece of clothing he had brought. It was black and made of some heavy, dense material. It must be a cape, I thought. I tried to put it on over my shoulders. I couldn't get it to fit. The man watched me for a little while, and then he lay back on the stream bank and began to laugh. He laughed till his eyes disappeared entirely and his face turned dark red. He curled up over his knees and laughed till you could tell it hurt him. And though it wasn't a noisy laugh, some men heard and came over and looked at him and looked at me, and some of them began laughing too. "Oh," he said at last, wiping his eyes and sitting up. "Oh, that did me good. That's a kilt, young'un. You wear it," and he began to laugh again, and doubled up, and wheezed, and finally said, "You wear it on the other end." I looked at the thing, and saw it had a waistband, like trousers. "I'll do without," I said, "if you don't mind." "No," he said, wheezing, "I don't mind. Give it back, then." "Why would the kid want one of your fool skirts, Jamry?" one of the onlookers said. "Here, kid, I'll get you something decent." He came back with a pair of breeches that fit me well enough, though loosely. When I had them on, he said, "Keep them. They're too tight for my belly." "So, you came in with Brigand and them today. Joining up, are you? What'll we call you?" "Gavir Arca," I said. The man who had given me the kilt said, "That's your name." I looked at him, not understanding. "Do you want to use it?" he asked. I had done so little thinking for so long, my mind wouldn't move quickly at all. It needed a lot of time. I said at last, "Gav." "Gav it is," said the man who had given me the kilt. "I'm Chemri, Baron of Bairnmont, and I use my name, for I'm so far from where I came that no one can track me by name or fame or any game." "He's from where the men wear skirts and the women piss standing," said one of the onlookers, and got some laughter from the others. "Lowlanders," said Chemri Bairn, of them, not to them. "They know no better. Come on, you, Gav. You'd better take the oath, if that's what you came for, and get your share of dinner.
I saw you carrying in your share of it and more.
The god Luck is deaf in one ear, they say, the ear we pray to. He can't hear our prayers. What he hears, what he listens to, nobody knows. Denios, the poet, said he hears the wheels of the stars' great chariots turning on the roads of heaven. I know that while I was sunk far beneath any thought of prayer, with no hope, no trust in anything, no desire, Luck was always with me. I lived, though I took no care to survive. I came to no harm among strangers. I carried money and was not robbed. When I was alone and on the verge of death, an old mad hermit beat me back to life. And now Luck had sent me to these men, and one of them was Chamri Bairn. Chamri went and whacked on a crowbar hung from a post of the largest hut. The signal brought men to gather around the porch of the hut. "Newcomer," he said. "Gav is his name. He says he's been living with Kuga the ogre, which would explain the smell that came with him. And after a bath in our river, he seeks to join our company. Right, Gav?" I nodded. I was intimidated by being the center of what seemed to me a great crowd of men, 20 or more, all looking me over. Most of them were young and had a trim, fit, hard look, like Brigand, the man who'd led me here, though there were several gray or bald heads and a couple of slack bellies. "Do you know who we are?" one of the bald heads demanded. I took a deep breath. "Are you the Barnavites?" That caused some scowling and some laughter. "Some of us used to be," the man said. "Maybe. And what do you know of Barna's lot, boy?" I was younger than they were, but I didn't like being called kid and boy all the time. It put my back up. I heard stories that they lived in the forest as free men, neither masters nor slaves, sharing fairly all they had.
"Well put," said Chamri. "All in a nutshell."
Several men looked pleased and nodded.
"Well enough. Well enough," the bald man said, keeping up his dignity.
Another man came up close to me. He looked very much like Brigand, and as I learned later, they were brothers. His face was hard and handsome, his eyes clear and cold. He looked me over.
"If you live with us, you'll learn what fair sharing means," he said. "It means what we do, you do. It's one for all with us. If you think you can do whatever you like, you won't last here. If you don't share, you don't eat. If you're careless and bring danger on us, you're dead. We have rules. You'll take an oath to live with us and keep our rules. And if you break that oath, we'll hunt you down. Surer than any slave taker."
Their faces were grim. They all nodded at what he said.
"You think you can keep that oath?"
"I can try," I said.
"Try's not good enough."
"I'll keep your oath," I said, my temper roused by his bullying.
"We'll see," he said, turning away. "Get the stuff, Modla."
The bald man and Brigand brought out of the hut a knife, a clay bowl, a deer antler, and some meal. I will not tell the ceremony, for those who go through it are sworn to secrecy, nor can I tell the words of the oath I took. They all swore that oath again with me. The rites and the oath-speaking brought them all together in fellow feeling, and when all was done and spoken, several of them came to pound my back and tell me I'd borne the initiation well, and was a brave fellow, and welcome among them. Chamri Bairn had come forward as my sponsor, and a young man called Vene as my hunting mate. They sat on either side of me at the celebration that followed. Meat had already been roasting on spits, but they added more to make a feast of it, and night had fallen by the time we sat to eat, on the ground or on stumps and crude stools around the red dancing fires. I had no knife. Vene took me to a chest of weapons and told me to choose one. I took a light, keen blade in a leather sheath. With it, I cut myself a chunk out of a sizzling, dripping, blackened, sweet-smelling haunch, and sat down with it and ate like a starved animal. Somebody brought me a metal cup and poured something into it, beer or mead, sour and somewhat foamy. The men laughed louder as they drank and shouted and laughed again. My heart warmed to their good fellowship, the friendship of the Forest Brothers. For that was the name they called themselves and had given me, since I was one of them. All around the firelit clearing was the night forest, utter darkness under the trees, high leaf crowns gray in the starlight for miles and miles. If Chamri Bairn hadn't taken a liking to me, and if Vene hadn't taken me as his hunting partner, I would have had a worse time of it that fall and winter than I did. As it was, I was often at the limit of my endurance. I'd lived wild with Kuga, but he'd looked after me, sheltered me, fed me, and that was in summer, too, when it's easy to live wild. Here, my city softness, my lack of physical strength, my ignorance of the skills of survival were nearly the death of me. Brigin and his brother Etter and several other men had been farm slaves, used to a hard life, tough, fearless, and resourceful, and to them I was a dead loss, a burden. Other men in the group, town bred, had some patience with my wretched incompetence and gave and taught me what I needed to get by. As with Kuga, my knack at fishing gave me a way to show I could try at least to be useful. I showed no promise at all in hunting, though Vene took me with him conscientiously and tried to train me with his short bow and in all the silent skills of the hunter. Vene was 20 or so. At 15, he had run away from a vicious master in a town of the region of Kasikar and made his way to the forest. For everybody in Kasikar, he said, knew about the Forest Brothers, and all the slaves dreamed of joining them. He enjoyed the life in the woods, seemed fully at home in it, and was one of the best hunters of our band. But I soon learned that he was restless. He didn't get on with Brigin and Etter. "Playing the masters," he said dryly, and after a while, "And they won't have women with us." "Well, Barna's men have women, right? I think of joining them."
"Think again," said Chamri, sewing a soft upper to a shoe sole. He was our tanner and cobbler, and made pretty good shoes and sandals for us of elk hide. "You'll be running back to us, begging us to save you. You think Brigand's bossy. Never was a man could match a woman for given orders. Men are by nature slaves to women, and women are by nature the masters of men. Hello, woman. Goodbye, freedom."
"Maybe," Vene said. "But there's other things comes with her." They were good friends, and included me in their friendship and their conversation. Many of the men of the band seemed to have little use for language, using a grunt or a gesture, or sitting stolid and mute as animals. The silence of the slave had gone so deep in them that they couldn't break it. Chamri, on the other hand, was a man of words. He loved to talk and listen and tell stories, rhyming and chiming them in a kind of half-poetry, and was ready to discuss anything with anybody. I soon knew his history,
or as much of it as he saw fit to tell, and as near or far from the truth as suited him. He came from the uplands, he said, a region far north and east of the city-states. I'd never heard of it, and asked him if it was farther than Urdile, and he said yes, far beyond Urdile, beyond even Benderman. I knew the name of Benderman only from the ancient tale, Chamhan. The uplands are beyond the beyond, he said, north of the moon and east of the dawn. A desolation of hill and bog and rock and cliff, and rising over it all a huge vast mountain with a beard of clouds. The Carantages. Nobody deserves to live in the uplands but sheep. It's starving land, freezing land, winter forever, a gleam of sunlight once a year. It's all cut up into little small domains, farms they'd call them here, and poor sorry farms at that, but in the uplands, they're domains. And each has a master, the Brantor, and each Brantor has an evil power in them. Witches they are, every one. How'd you like that for a master? A man who could move his hand and say a word and turn you inside out with your guts on the ground and your eyes staring into the inside of your brain. Or a man who could look at you and you'd never think a thought of your own again, but only what he put into your head. He liked to go on about these awful powers, the gifts, he called them, of the upland witches, his tails growing even taller. I asked him once if he'd had a master, what his master's power was. That silenced him for a minute. He looked at me with his bright, narrow eyes. You wouldn't think it much of a power, maybe, he said. Nothing to see. He could weaken the bones in a body. It took a while. But if he cast his power on you, in a month you'd be weak and weary. In half a year your legs would bend under you like grass. In a year you'd be dead. You don't want to cross a man who could do that. Oh, you lowlanders think you know what it is to have a master. In the uplands, we don't even say slave. The Branters people, we say. He may be kin to half of them, his servants, his serfs, his people. But they're more slaves to him than ever the slave of the worst master down here. I don't know about that, said Vene. A whip and a couple of big dogs can do about as well as a spell of magic to destroy a man. Vene bore terrible scars on his legs and back and scalp, and one ear had been half torn off his head. No, no, it's the fear, Chamri said. It's the awful fear. You didn't fear the men that beat you and the dogs that bit you. Once you'd run clear away from them, did you? But I tell you, I ran 100 miles away from the uplands and my master, and still I cringed when I felt his thought turn on me. And I felt it. The strength went out of my legs and arms. I couldn't hold my back up straight. His power was on me. All I could do was go on, go on, go on, till there was mountains and rivers and miles between me and his hand and eye and cruel power. When I crossed the great river, the Trond, I grew stronger. When I crossed the second great river, the Sally, I was safe at last. The power can cross a wide water once, but not twice. So a wise woman told me, but I crossed yet another to be sure. I'll never go back north, never. You don't know what it is to be a slave, you lowlanders. Yet Chamri talked often of the uplands and the farm where he had been born.
and all through his railing at it as a poor, unhappy, wretched place, I heard his yearning homesickness. He made of it a vivid picture in my mind. The great barren moorlands and cloudy peaks, the bogs from which at dawn 1,000 wild white cranes would rise at once, the stone-walled, slate-roofed farm huddled under the bare curve of a brown hill. As he told about it, I could see it almost as clearly as if I remembered it myself. And that put me in mind of my own power, or whatever it was, of remembering what was yet to happen. I remembered that I had such a power once, but when I thought about that, I began to remember places I didn't want to remember. Memories made my body hunch up in pain and my mind go blank in fear. I pushed them away, turned away from them. Remembering would kill me. Forgetting kept me alive. The Forrest brothers were all men who had escaped, run away from something unendurable. They were like me. They had no past. Learning how to get through this rough life, how to endure never being dry or warm or clean, to eat only half-raw, half-burnt venison, I might have gone on with them as I had with Kuga, not thinking beyond the present hour and what was around me. And much of the time, I did. But there were times when winter storms kept us in our drafty, smoky cabins, and Chamri, Vene, and some of the other men gathered to talk in the half-dark by the smoldering hearth. And then I began to hear their stories of where they came from, how they'd lived, the masters they'd escaped from, their memories of suffering and of pleasure. Sometimes into my thoughts would come a clear image of a place, a big room full of women and children, a fountain in a city square, a sunny courtyard surrounded by arches under which women sat spinning. When I saw such a place, I gave it no name, and my mind turned away from it hastily. I never joined the others' talk about the world outside the forest, and didn't like to hear it. Late one afternoon, the 6 or 7 tired, dirty, hungry men around the crude hearth in our cabin had run out of anything to talk about. We all sat in a dumb discouragement. It had been raining a cold, hard rain almost ceaselessly for 4 days and nights. Under the cloud that pressed down on the dark forest trees, it seemed night all day long. Fog and darkness tangled in the wet, heavy boughs. To go out to get logs for the fire from the dwindling woodpile was to be wet through at once. And indeed, some of us went out naked, since skin dries quicker than cloth and leather. One of our mates, Bullock, had a wretched cough that shook him about like a rat in a dog's mouth. Even Chamri had run out of jokes and tall tales. In that cold, dreary place, I was thinking of summer, of the heat and light of summer on the open hills somewhere. And a cadence came into my mind, a beat, and the words with it, and without any intention, I said the words aloud. As in the dark of winter night, the eyes seek dawn. As in the bonds of bitter cold, the heart craves sun. So blinded and so bound, the soul cries out to thee. Be our light, our fire, our life, liberty. Ah, Chamri said out of a silence that followed the words. I've heard that. Heard it sung. There's a tune to it. I sought the tune, and little by little, it came to me, with the sound of the beautiful voice that had sung it. I have no singing voice, but I sang it. That's fine, Venice said softly.
Bullock coughed and said, "Speak some more such."
"Do that," Chamri said.
I looked into my mind for more remembered words to speak to them. Nothing came for a while. What I found at last was a line of writing. I read it. "Wearing the white of mourning, the maiden mounted the high steps." I said it aloud, and in a moment the line led me on to the next, and that to the next. So I told them the part of Garo's poem in which the prophetess Yurno confronts the enemy hero Rurek. Standing on the walls of Sentas, a girl in mourning, Yurno calls down to the man who killed her warrior father. She tells Rurek how he will die. "Beware of the hills of Trebs," she says, "for you will be ambushed in the hills. You will run away and hide in the bushes, but they will kill you as you try to crawl away without being seen. They will drag your naked body to the town and display it, sprawled face down, so all can see that the wounds are in your back. Your corpse will not be burned with prayers to the ancestors, as befits a hero, but buried where they bury slaves and dogs." Enraged at her prophecy, Rurek shouts, "And this is how you will die, lying sorceress," and hurls his heavy lance at her. All see it pass through her body just below the breast and fly out, trailing blood behind her, but she stands on the battlement in her white robes, unharmed. Her brother, the warrior Alira, picks up the lance and hands it up to her, and she tosses it down to Rurek, not hurling it, but end over end, lightly, contemptuously. "When you're running away and hiding, you'll want this," she says, "great hero of Pagadi." As I spoke the words of the poem, in that cold, smoky hut in the half-dark, with the noise of the rain loud on the low roof, I saw them written in some pupil's labored handwriting in the copybook I held as I stood in the schoolroom in Archimonde. "Read the passage, Gavir," my teacher said, and I read the words aloud. A silence followed.
"Hey, that's a fool," Bakok said. "Throwing the lance at a witch. Don't he know can't kill a witch but with fire?"
Bakok was a man of 50 by the look of him, though it's hard to tell the age of men who have lived their life half-starved and under the whip. Maybe he was 30.
"That's a good bit of story," Chamri said. "There's more? Is there a name to it?"
I said, "It's called The Siege and Fall of Sentas." "There's more."
"Let's have it," said Chamri, and the others all agreed.
For a time, I couldn't recall the opening lines of the poem. Then, as if I had the old copybook in my hand, there they were, and I spoke them. "To the councils and senate of Sentas they came, the envoys in armor, with their swords in their hands, arrogant, striding into the chamber where the lords of the city sat to give judgment." It was night. True night, when I finished saying the first book of the poem. Our fire had burned down to embers on the rough hearth, but nobody in the circle of men had moved to build it up. Nobody had moved at all for an hour.
"They're going to lose that city of theirs," Bullock said, in the dark, in the soft drumming of the rain. "They should be able to hold out. The others come too far from home, like Kasikar did, trying to take Etra last year," said Taffa.
It was the most I'd ever heard him say.
Venna had told me Taffa had been not a slave, but a freeman of a small city-state, conscripted into their army. During a battle, he had escaped and made his way to the forest. Sad-faced and aloof, he seldom said anything, but now he was arguing almost volubly. "Stretched out their forces too far, see, Pagadi has, attacking. If they don't take the town by assault quick, they'll starve come winter." And they all got into the discussion, all talking exactly as if the siege of Centos was taking place right now, right here, as if we were living in Centos. Of them all, Chamri was the only one who understood that what I had told them was a poem, a thing made by a maker, a work of art, part history of long ago, part invention. It was, to them, an event. It was happening as they heard it. They wanted it to go on happening. If I'd been able to, they'd have kept me telling it to them night and day. But after my voice gave out that first evening, I lay in my wooden bunk thinking about what had been given back to me. The power of words. I'd time then to think and to plan how and when to use that power. How to go on with a poem, to keep them from exhausting both it and me. I ended by telling it for an hour or two every night, after we ate. For the winter nights were endless, and something to make them pass was welcome to all. Word got about, and within a night or two, most of the men of the band were crowded into our hut for telling the war, and for the long, passionate discussions and arguments about tactics and motives and morals that followed. There were times I couldn't fully recall the lines as Garo wrote them, but the story was clear in my mind, so I filled in these gaps with tags of the poetry and my own narrative until I came again to a passage that I had by memory, or could see written, and could fall back into the harsh rhythm of the lines. My companions didn't seem to notice the difference between my prose and Garo's poetry. They listened closest when I was speaking the poetry, but those were also often the most vivid passages of action and suffering. When we came again in the course of the tale to the passage I'd recited first, Yurno's prophecy from the battlements, Bacchok caught his breath, and when Rurik, in a fury, uplifts his heavy lance, Bacchok cried out, "Don't throw it, man, it's no good." The others shouted at him to pipe down, but he was indignant. "Don't he know it's no good? He'd thrown it before." I was at first merely bemused by my own capacity to recall the poetry and their capacity to listen to it. They didn't say much to me about it, but it made a difference in the way I was treated, my standing among them. I had something they wanted, and they respected me for that. Since I gave it freely, their respect was ungrudging. "Hey, haven't you got a fatter rib than that for the kid? He's got to work tonight, telling the war." But every up's a down, as Chamri said. Brigin and his brother and the men closest to them, their cabin mates, looked in at one time or another on the recital, listened a while, standing near the doorway, then left in silence. They said nothing to me, but I heard from others that they said men who listened to fools' tales were worse fools than those who told them. And Brigin said that a man willing to hear a boy yammer book talk half the night was no fit forest brother. Book talk? Why did Brigin say it in that contemptuous tone? There were no books in the forest. There had been no books in Brigin's life. Why did he sneer at them? Any of these men might well be jealous of a knowledge that had been jealously kept from them. A farm slave who tried to learn to read could have his eyes put out or be whipped to death. Books were dangerous, and a slave had every excuse to fear them. But fear is one thing, contempt another. I resented their sneers as mean-spirited, for I couldn't see anything unworthy of manhood in the tale I was telling. How was a tale of warfare and heroism weakening the men who listened to it so hungrily every night? Didn't it draw us together in real brotherhood when after the telling we listened to one another argue the rights and wrongs of the general's tactics and the warrior's exploits? To sit stupid, mute, night after night, under the rain like cattle, bored to mindlessness, was that what made us men? Etter said something one morning, knowing he was within my hearing, about great idle fools listening to a boy tell lies. I was fed up. I was about to confront him with what I've just said, when my wrist was caught in an iron grip, and a deft foot nearly tripped me. I broke free and shouted, "What do you think you're doing?" to Chamri Baron, who apologized for his clumsiness while renewing his grip on my wrist. "I'll keep your trap shut, Gav," he whispered desperately, hauling me away from the group of men around Etter. "Don't you see he's baiting you? He's insulting all of us. And who's to stop him? You?" Chamri had got me around behind the woodpiles now, away from the others, and seeing I was now arguing with him, not challenging Etter, he let go my wrist. "But why don't they love you for having a power they don't have?" I didn't know what to say. "And they've got the hard hand, you know, though you've got the soft voice. Oh, Gav, don't be smarter than your masters. It costs." In his face now was the sadness I had seen in the face of every one of these men, the mark of the harrow. They'd all started with very little and lost most of that. "They're not my masters," I said furiously. "We're free men here." "Well," Chamri said, "in some ways..."